This is the UCLA Mindful Weekly Lecture. Each week, Diana Winston, or one of our UCLA Mindful teachers, offers a talk about mindfulness to deepen our understanding and cultivate well-being. Thanks for joining us.
So before I launch into the last of the ethical guidelines, I want to check in about last week. We did a follow-up to the guideline around what we consume, and people shared the way they were working with the particularly phone and media and technology. That seemed to be sort of one of the main thing that people were working on. Then I followed up with the guideline around how we not taking what hasn't been offered to us. And then we talked about different ways we might practice this week with generosity. So I'm curious if anybody is willing to share if they worked on anything, either a continuation from an earlier week or last week. And welcome to, I'd love to hear what happened if you did. And so you can put that into the chat or come on camera, your choice. Or did you just completely forget? Okay, I'll give you a little time. Yes, yeah, Shelley? Oh, Shelley, you're on mute.
Can you hear me now?
I can.
Okay. I broke my ankle a number of months ago and had surgery, and I'm still in physical therapy. And while I was doing physical therapy, my friend called me. We were trying to look for something fun to do together. And she said, "You want to go to a rodeo?" And my first reaction, I live in Massachusetts. I never knew there were rodeos around here. And my first reaction was, that would be a lot of fun. You know, I've never been to a rodeo. And then thinking about it, I started thinking about the animals. And it really, I started, you know, if they're going to rope calves or something, I really don't want to see that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I texted my friend, I'm not sure because I don't know how I'd feel about the way they treat the animals. And then I went on the rodeo's website, and seeing the videos, it just struck me. It turned out my friend found out they do rope calves. And just watching the people on the bulls and stuff, it really upset me. You know, and I thought about dealing with, you know, life and how we treat life, all beings. And it really, I've never thought about a rodeo, you know, but it was interesting to see my reaction. Because at first, you know, if I ever thought about going to a rodeo, I'd think, oh, this is fun, you know, this is going to be fun. And then when I really thought about it,
Yeah. So interesting, Shelley. Thank you for telling this and yes, surprising that it's in your neck of the woods, but evidently it is.
Yeah. It was like a town fair or something, you know.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. But I think what you're pointing to is really a sensitivity that begins to emerge in all of us when we start to take ethical guidelines seriously. Yeah. And then we start noticing things we might not have noticed and noticing how it feels inside. And then you can kind of align it with, oh, well, this is against this guideline that I really value. And so it's a good example of how we wake up a little more to things. So thank you for telling us about that. Awesome. Hiroki wrote, "I was able to practice simplicity in consumption and also in idea or ambition, meeting desires with an idea of simplicity. So that's connected, I think, to what we were talking about last week with the way that we can have sort of like a greedy mind thinking, I need this, I need that. And a lot of what I was mostly talking about was like things, right? Oh, taking this, taking that. But you're really talking about how you, well, actually it's related to both the consumption one and the not taking, right? It's almost like rather than needing something to make you happy, you're sort of going back into simplicity. Like, is that right, Hiroki? So it's a beautiful practice. Simplicity in how we relate to our ideas, our ambitions. And that's not to say that we shouldn't have wonderful ideas and shouldn't have ambition. It's not that. But when does it become like, I want this thing and I have to have it. If I don't have it, it's horrible. My life is over. That kind of that tension around it versus meeting it with like, okay, here's a desire that's interesting to me that I'm seems like something important, but can I hold it lightly? And with, I like the word simplicity. So yeah, thank you for that. Gabby said, I thought a lot about taking what is not offered, but on the other hand, was more intentional about offering things to others. I realized I often assume that people will know that I want to help or that I will happily do things. Yeah, that is a lovely way to think about it. Like it's not just about not taking, but again, it's about how we can give, how we can practice generosity. And you're saying you realize you often assume people will know that I want to help or that I will happily do things. And are you saying that maybe that's not the case? They don't always know. And so making that helping them be aware that you are there to help, right? That might be an interesting practice. So great. That sounds like a good exploration. Paula said, I've been mindful of food consumption and quality this year, aware of what I want versus what I need. Yeah, so this is again these two guidelines kind of coming together, these two ethical guidelines, what we consume and then how we practice simplicity, non-attachment, generosity, all these other like the other side of that fourth one that we did. I continue to work on no morning TV or phone first thing in the morning. I still need to work on mindless scrolling on Instagram when I do check it. Okay, but you've been working on no morning TV or phone. So that's fantastic. And it is work, right? Like it's easy. I noticed that I had gotten like pretty good. I was because we've been discussing this stuff. So I was doing really well with my phone. And then the next thing I knew, I was like sucked back into it. I'm like, what just happened? So I mean, it's a process that we can practice with. And then there'll be an area that you start to feel more aligned with yourself. Like maybe, oh, the fact that I'm not looking at the phone in the morning is really in alignment with me, but over the Instagram, not so much. So then you just really gently, lovingly turn to that area and play with that and see what happens if I cut it back by 5 minutes. You don't know. Remember we talked about that a couple weeks ago, not taking on like a giant thing, but like a simpler, easier thing to do. So you can give that a try. I was working myself with that guideline, that precept of generosity, and I was looking at how I tip people in restaurants, and I realized that it can be a place that I tend to be like a little like contracted, like, well, I don't know. And then one of my friends said to me, like, people like maybe you can consider that it might mean a lot more to that person than it means to me. And that made me be like, okay, I'm going to be more generous. And I was playing with that. And it's been feeling really good, like, but also noticing the edge. So it's just a fun thing to practice and deepen our understanding. Remember, with all of this, we make a decision, we act with mindfulness, and then we see the internal repercussions of our decision. And then we forgive ourselves. We get curious about things. We, as I said, sometimes we talked about making amends if needed. So nice. Someone mentioned there are a few non-animal rodeos. Good to hear. I didn't know. I don't know that. Manjay said, I've been overall more aware of my mind and how it creates concepts. But also, since my teacher's name is on my book for his foreword, I'm now hyper aware of my actions that would not harm his name. The bliss of blamelessness. Yeah, right. So that's what we talked about, the bliss of blamelessness. And then Martha also said, I remembered what you had said about the bliss of blamelessness. I noticed that when instead of trying to get the other person to admit they're wrong, instead I did the kind thing. Maybe that was the bliss of blamelessness. Yeah. I mean, that's a nice interpretation of it. Like just being willing to not be right. It's okay not to be right. I'm sure you've all heard that phrase. Everybody says it all the time. Would you rather be right or would you rather be happy? You know, when you're in a fight with someone, would you rather be right or happy? A lot of times the answer is right. I'd rather be right. And then you got to kind of work with that. I'm right. But if I keep holding strongly to that view and trying to get them, as Martha's saying, to admit they're wrong, I'm going to suffer a lot and our relationship's going to suffer. And what if I just back into simplicity, back into these non-attachment practices, kind of bliss of blamelessness. So Hiroki was responding to Dana and the whole Instagram and so on, said, during the week, I realized that the challenge from last week was aspirational content viewing would also help me with my practice for this week of simplicity. Great. Yeah, they're tied together. They're totally tied. You're seeing how, you know, it's a framework that's like there's this, there's this, there's this, there's this. There's not killing, there's respecting life. I mean, the first one, respecting life, is like intertwined in all of the five of them. There's not killing, not stealing, being wise with our speech, being generous, and being grounded with our consumption. And then and here's the last couple, and then we'll move on. I was trying to give more time and be more present with my family. I had some success with this and it felt good. However, I found my demanding job created some tension with this goal. So it's a lovely act of generosity when we can say, I'm going to use this time to be more present. And it's not always easy, as I think you're pointing out, but that's great that that was your decision that you tried that. Oh my goodness, there's so many here. Okay. I thought about how much I have been spending and ended up making a very large donation to the Red Cross. Beautiful. That's a lovely thing, Ron. When living more ethically involves making drastic changes from most social conditioning, how can life's habits be changed more willingly with less feeling of deprivation? Oh, okay. This is a great question. I'm going to go do the last one and then I'll come back to that. Working on becoming aware of what I think my partner should do, mostly around chores. Yes, the bliss of blamelessness. Everybody likes that phrase. It's a gorgeous phrase, right? Immediately improved our communication, allowing me to be generous and light. Okay, so what I'm hearing is that the expectations that we have towards our partners or children or whomever around what they think, how we're holding tightly around how we think they should be, and if we can just sort of soften a little bit and let them, you know, be who they are. Not that you can't offer suggestions and so forth, but it allows you, like you said, to be generous and light without, because you're not holding on so tightly to this view and opinion. And then there's this the bliss of blamelessness, which in some initially when I was teaching it, we were talking about the when you're living an ethical life, there's a blameless quality. But what I'm also hearing with a couple of you are how it's about stopping blaming others. And that's another way it's also can lead to bliss. So good job. All right. And then I'm going to try to get to Sandy's question. When living more ethically involves making drastic changes from most social conditioning, how can a life's habit be changed more willingly with less feeling of deprivation? Well, for very simple thing is starting small. You know, don't be like, let's say you're a meat eater and you want to just switch over to not eating meat because that feels aligned with your values. I wouldn't say just like go a cold turkey, you know, no meat ever again. I would do it in stages and, you know, do it once a week, do it, you know, a couple meals every few, you know, just stage it and then see how that feels. And if that feels doable and it actually leads to more happiness, then do more. So keep in mind that With our mindfulness practice, we can make a choice and then notice how it feels. And if it feels like, oh no, I've pushed myself too far, then we can step back. And if the feeling, sometimes that feeling of deprivation is hard to tolerate. And if that's the case, we bring our mindfulness to what that is and then bring some kindness and then don't push ourselves too much. However, sometimes we push ourselves. Push is even the wrong word, but like invite ourselves to do something a little bit out of a stretch, and it feels really good, and it doesn't feel like deprivation. It feels like, oh, I'm living aligned with what I really, really care about, and that is something to pay attention to. So I love the question, and I hope that's kind of getting at it. Shelley, okay, let's do last one, and then yeah, go ahead.
Hi. This is my first time on Wednesday, but I was with you for half an hour before once. So I have been practicing your talk in Dharma Seed. So this morning I was following investigative awareness. Which is rain, recognize and allow and investigate and nourishing. So I have been a meditator for a while now, 5 to 6 years, and sometimes when the unpleasant sensation is awareness itself, I won't say it's an sensation. It's sometimes too much zooming in. It become unwanted. So how to bring that into attention? How to do that skillfully, deal with that skillfully? Did you
Are you
understand
asking
why?
how to bring awareness of awareness in skillfully, or yeah. Okay.
Sometimes I find sometimes because I haven't practicing for a while, and so sometimes I feel my body, let's say for example, body sensation, and it gets really zoomed in, and that becomes unpleasant for me. So how to deal with that skillfully?
Yeah, so I'll just because that's a great question. It's a lot, and for right now, but I want to tell you. Just I'll give you 2 seconds, and then we'll like. So when you notice your mind getting drawn into something, and it feels like it's too much, and it feels a little overwhelming, move into a more spacious practice, such as opening your awareness to sounds, softening your body, relaxing, letting yourself be without trying to kind of follow every single sensation. And so that's kind of like the general instruction if your mind gets too caught by too many things. I'm going to be teaching a whole class on how to work with all the different modes that's coming up in September. So that might be a way to kind of dive in more deeply around it on the spectrum of awareness. So, and I'm happy to answer this question down on the road too, because I want to jump into the
No, I thought I would join this Wednesday class. It's a bit odd time for me because I'm connecting from the UK, but once in a week, that's fine.
Okay, well, you're up pretty late.
I am a bit late.
Yeah.
That's fine.
All right.
Thank you so
Well,
much.
welcome. Welcome. Thanks, Shelley. Okay, so let's look at the last one that we have not dealt with, and that is the it's technically the third one in the way the formulation is done, but it's the mindfulness of sex, or what the main precept is, to refrain from what's called sexual misconduct. So what is sexual misconduct? Now, in the kind of traditional frameworks that these come from in the Buddhist language, it's wrong or evil conduct with regard to sensual things. These are, I'm just giving you everything in quotes here. Unlawful sexual intercourse. It refers to adultery, intercourse with minors, persons under a guardianship. And so this is sort of like the traditional understanding of it. So it's really the and you know, obviously this particular guideline you see in every religion, more or less, I think probably in all of them. And it's usually like no adultery, right? I think that a broader understanding that's more not, I mean, adultery may be relevant to some of us, but is not harming through our sexual energy or activity. Okay, because sex is an area that can cause enormous suffering. And I know as we move into this topic right now, this may be relevant to some people in this room and may not be relevant to other people in this room. So I'm gonna give a spin on it in a little while for those of you. I mean, people are at really different phases of life. I see I have young people in the room, I have people in their senior years, and not that I don't know where you are, and some of you are partnered and some of you are not partnered, and some of you like all different choices around our choices of whom we love and how we love and what we do, and it's all like everything is totally welcome here. So some of what I'm going to say is going to be relevant to some of you, some of what I'm going to say is going to be not, and we'll just keep going with that. So we have the acknowledgement that sex can cause a lot of suffering. This precept, this guideline is about protecting the integrity of ourselves and of others, right? And protecting those bringing care to what we do with our sexual energy. So not using our sexual energy or activity in a way that could harm or cause harm to ourselves or to others, to be wise with it, to protect relationships is another way of talking about it. So this is an area that as I mentioned, there's a lot of suffering. My guess is in most of our life stories, we have a time in our life where we may have acted out of our unconscious patterns, where we might have hurt people. Not everyone, but there's a lot of stories I've heard over the years and have my own of places where I feel like I unskillfully used my sexual energy or made an unskillful choice. People have done it a lot more oftentimes when they're younger, but not always. Sometimes people have been unskillful because they're in a conscious way because they're trying to be deliberately harmful. And sometimes they're just ruled by maybe addiction, or it just feels like it's like something that might feel kind of very hard to control. And so I want to acknowledge again the spectrum of where people are with this. So it might be something very subtle in your life. It might be something that people are dealing with in a very intense way. So using our sexual activity in a way that is harmful is fairly obvious to see. But the energy piece, I keep saying sexual energy, what does that mean? Sort of I hope people know what I'm talking about. Like our sexual, when we use our sexual energy to get something we want, to achieve a goal, to make someone fall in love with you or have something that who somebody that you're doing it out of a kind of like unconscious place and possibly potentially hurtful, especially if you have no intention to follow up. So it goes back to exactly the same thing as all the other guidelines about wanting a mind of integrity, of feeling good about myself. Not, remember I said integrity is not what feels good, but what feels good about myself. And then living with the acknowledgement of interdependence that we're all so deeply connected to each other. So one of the ways of thinking about it is if I'm feeling confused about a particular action related to sex or sexuality, we might ask, could this result in me or someone getting hurt? Right, that's like a great question. It's a great question for every single one of these guidelines. Could someone get hurt if I do this thing that I'm contemplating? Could someone get hurt? And do I want to do that? In which case, might I refrain? And mindfulness is so helpful to get clear on our motivation because sometimes we don't really know why we're doing something. A lot of people even do things out of like super unconsciously, like out of boredom or loneliness or to get back at someone or because they're jealous or, and a lot of these things are deep, deep buried. So With our mindfulness, if we start to examine our motivation, it's a very profound kind of practice of being authentic and honest with ourselves and looking at something and going, oh, why did I make this choice? Oh, I made this choice because I was lonely. Oh, okay. And if I really think about it, it's not aligned with my integrity. So we can use mindfulness to understand ourselves better in this way. Now, in a partnered relationship, what might sexual misconduct be? And there could be, as we said, the really extreme cases of adultery. I hate that word adultery. It's so old-fashioned, but it means, in case you're not aware, it means having sex with someone who is not your partner and who's somebody else's part, sorry, who's someone else's partner, right? But the more subtle forms that might happen, or like, in other words, cheating on some, like it's technically called cheating on someone. In a partnered relationship, it might be more subtle. It might be something like withholding sexuality as a kind of payback. It might be being attuned, misattuned and deliberately like having no interest in getting more attuned. I'm questioning this. I don't know if this is sexual misconduct, but is it not being really present, you know, being disconnected and over habitually. Of course, there are many times in sex people are disconnected, but habitually and deliberately numbing out, objectifying our partner in some way. Right. These are all ways of starting to see, like, oh, how am I aligned with my values? And sometimes we do these things out of fear. Sometimes we do these things out of unconsciousness. Sometimes, right? So it's not always like I'm mad at this person and therefore I'm gonna numb out and ignore them. It's not like that. But how do we use mindfulness to pay close attention? When I feel confused, I might ask, could this result in harm for myself or others? And then err on the side of caution. Now, in the Buddhist world, there are monks and nuns who choose celibacy. And celibacy is interesting because obviously, this is a lecture I'm giving to lay people, and I'm not recommending it. But I will tell you that it is when I've done it for periods of time, and I did it within like a spiritual context where I was meditating and you had to do it. It's a beautiful practice. And it can be something where you like that part of you just sort of not because you judge it or you think there's something wrong with it, but you just say, I'm going to put this on hold to focus on this thing that's really important to me, which is the meditation practice. So when I was living in a monastery, I was a Buddhist nun, so I did not have any sexual activity. That was one of the commitments. And it was just like to have a life devoted to my practice, and it wasn't like kind of I don't know what the word is, but like sexuality can be very big, very, especially I was a younger person, right? Very like a flame, you know, and instead it was much cooler. But I'm going to get to some other aspects of this. And I will say that I know there are people who have practiced celibacy in their lives, making the decision to do it because maybe they've acted out a lot sexually and they want to spend some time kind of reconnecting with themselves and finding a new way to understand their relationship to sexuality. So that's just something that I just wanted to throw in there because it's kind of an interesting possibility for some people. And there are people who make that choice, like people who identify as ace or asexual, and there's a whole world of beauty that happens when people make that choice. So constantly coming back to our motivation, what are we doing here? Clearly we're going to mess up. We are human. There are some people who, when they look at this precept, they're very, very clear about like, this precept means you cannot be engaged in sex without love and long-term commitment. So, for instance, if you looked at Thich Nhat Hanh's version of the precepts, there's a lot that says do not have sex without love and long-term commitment. And yet there's this whole world of people who are engaging in sex in a, my understanding is, in sort of in healthy and transparent ways that I don't have any need to judge. And I don't feel like, for some people, that some people I know, people I know right now, like for instance, there's a lot of it, people who are in polyamorous relationships, and you know, I don't judge. Like I really want people to find what works for them as long as they're staying in integrity, you know. And that's the thing to pay attention to, like where is the place that I'm not in integrity. So for those of us who are not sexually active, we might look at this precept around intimacy and intimacy with whomever, whether it's intimacy with a friend, whether it's intimacy with a partner, whether it's intimacy with our children, whether it's intimacy with the world, the natural world. What is our relationship to that? You know, it's something to explore as part of this ethical training, like what fosters intimacy? Where do I find it in my life? When I find it, how does it feel? And what hinders it? And what am I a person who avoids it? You know, am I a person who like will do everything I possibly can not to reveal myself, not to get vulnerable, not to, right? So these are all interesting questions for all of us. And that might be a way of looking at this if this the piece on sexuality isn't as relevant for you. And then there's, of course, the larger social political domain that we have covered with all of these, such as what does it mean to be living in the world with trafficking of women and children, with the sex industry, with the advertising industry, with, you know, there's such misconduct that's happening on a larger political level, and not political, but like larger institutional global level. And in Thich Nhat Hanh's version of the precept, he says, I will do everything in my power to protect children from sexual abuse and to prevent couples and families from being broken by sexual misconduct. It's a way to look at this precept. And like always, we have to find our way. Okay. Everybody's going to find your way with this. And I just keep hope. I hope that what I'm doing is pointing back to mindfulness, checking our motivation, getting clear, becoming sensitive, acting and noticing what's happening internally. It's the guideline for every single one of these. And with this one, as I mentioned, because it can be so rough, it takes extra care. So that being said, there's a second part to this talk, which is, but how can mindfulness be helpful with sex, right? Because now I've just been giving you the kind of like the don't framework, but then there's also like, what can we do? You know, and I will talk about that depending on time, but I just want to see if there are any questions or clarifications or comments based on what I've just said about how to perceive this guideline. Someone said, how do you converse about this with a partner who can't see their own sexual energy drawing others in? Oh boy. Yeah, that's a hard question. I think that finding a really low stakes, meaning non-charged, way to share what you're feeling and observing, perhaps even in the context of within a therapy session or something, to share, because that if the other person isn't seeing what they're doing with their sexual energy and it's harming you, they might feel really defensive and reactive. So I'm a big fan of things like couples therapy. And then if the person can move through maybe some reactivity or shame around it and get to the place where they're seeing what they're doing, then a collaborative approach to supporting them to work on it differently and to have a different approach. So That's a tough one. I mean, as I always said, people have been with me for years know that I always say you can't change anybody but yourself, right? All we can do here is work on ourselves, but we can certainly get support to help with people who are challenging to us in whatever way. So, okay, so just want to give it another minute and see if there's any more questions or comments or thoughts about this particular guideline. It's everybody just wanting me to get to the fun part, like how can mindfulness help sexuality or sex and so forth. I'm happy to go to that. Okay. So I'm not going to say I'm not gonna, this could be like another hour talk or something, but I'll just say some basic things. There's a lot in these guidelines about don't do this, don't do that, refrain from this. I also want to share that the world of sexuality is also a beautiful field for mindfulness. And what if it could sex itself can be an incredible place of awareness and connection and love and intimacy. And I've asked this question to many people, but if you were to guess what the single most important thing that makes sex good, what would it be? Anybody know? You can put it into the chat. What's the single most important thing? Of course, there are many things, but what might be? Okay, connection, presence. What else? Intimacy. Love. Vulnerability, friends. All right, communication. So guess what? All of these things are correct, right? Everything is true, but I will say what no one has said is mindfulness. Mindfulness. There's a lot of people out there doing research and looking at the relationship of mindfulness to sex and seeing that people who are mindful are learning skills that can be like tremendously helpful in their sex lives. So there's a couple of areas that we can look at this. So it's mindfulness of self, mindfulness of emotions, mindfulness of connection, mindfulness of the other person. There's like so many ways. So one thing is to notice, let me just see, there's a couple of things. I'm not going to go into a huge deal about this, but so there's research showing that it's the sex can improve through moving into our bodies and out of our heads, essentially. So it's like when we're very, lost in our heads, worrying, upset about something, thinking about all the 5,000 other things you have to do, worrying how my body looks, like all of these things are killers for sex. And so when people begin to tune into their sensations and kind of move out of that part of the brain that's responding to that's kind of like the everyday brain into like a deeper self-connection, there's so much positivity that happens. There's a researcher named Dr. Lori Brotteaux, Brotto. She's a Canadian researcher. She's written some books on mindfulness and sex, and she's been researching these. And she's been involved in leading several randomized clinical trials evaluating mindfulness-based treatments for problems of low sexual desire, loss of arousal, sexual distress related to trauma, erectile dysfunction, all sorts of things. And she's interested in anyway, she's done a huge amount of work on this and has written some books. So if you're interested, that would be a good place to start to see what she's done and what she's shown. And she's created a program that people who are dealing with some of these things I mentioned go through. And there's a lot of good research looking at how it improves their sex lives and their connection. And then there is a mindfulness, a completely mindfulness-based practice that was developed in the 1970s by some of you may be familiar with Masters and Johnson. Masters and Johnson was the they were like the sex researchers in the 1970s. There was a whole TV show about them. And they developed something called sensate-focused sex therapy, which is essentially mindfulness-based skills for learning more body attunement. And it's really cool. If you look it up, it's just like, oh, it's about teaching people how to tune into their sensations and be in their bodies. And when people can do that, like I said, the ordinary mind gets less predominant, and the sort of what do you call it? Just like the sensate brain, the parts of us that are connected deeply to ourselves begin to emerge more. And people report that that improves their sex lives. So it's not just it's learning to notice sensations. It's using mindfulness to dive deeply into what our body wants. It's using mindfulness to be aware of our inner emotional states, which there's a lot of, people, especially maybe people in long-term relationships, people in short-term, there's a lot of emotions that are connected to sex. And so mindfulness can be brought in there. And then mindful speaking and listening communication is incredibly helpful in people's sex lives. Learning, and you can even do, for those of you who've done relational mindfulness practices, something that can be brought into partnered relationships, or and it's also so I'm just giving you a little like taste of it. And then the quality of presence, of really showing up and not numbing out and being fully present. This is mindfulness based. So there's a lot of ways that mindfulness, through the research shows it, and through these practices and things that you can learn, can invite like the all other side of the precept, which is it's not just don't dote, but it's also how can we use our mindfulness to open up the beauty and the power of us as sexual beings, for those of us who have made that choice. And there's just a lot here to explore. Last week, I mentioned that I talked about the precepts from Manzanita Village, and there were five of them. And I want to read their version of this precept. Aware of the abuse and lovelessness in the world, and of the healing that is made possible when we open to love. I love that. The healing that is made possible when we open to love. I stand in the presence of the ancestors, the earth, and future generations. That's in all of them. And vow to cultivate respect for the beauty and erotic power of our bodies. It's a very different version than that. What was the very first one that I said? I think I used them like very early traditional, like no sexual misconduct. I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. It's important. That's actually the basis, because you can't, if you're in doing sexual misconduct, there's no way you can be in truth and authenticity and transparency in sexuality using mindfulness. You've got to also have this ethics, and then they go hand in hand. So anyway, those are some thoughts on this precept, which is quite interesting. And I'll see if there are any questions, and we'll do a short meditation before we close.
Diana.
Yes.
Can you say the name of the woman that you mentioned before, Masters and Johnson?
Oh, Lori Brado. Here, I'll type it in.
Thank you.
Anyway, she has a book. Someone can maybe look it up for me right now, but I think it's just like mindfulness. It's like mindfulness and sex. But I mean, there's a catchier title than that. Dr. Lori Brado. She's probably the main person that I'm aware of, but certainly not the only one researching the connection between sex and mindfulness. Oh, there we go. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Oh, we got the. Okay, well, it seems like you're going to let that sort of settle and think about it for yourself. And it's the last one in this whole set of ethical guidelines that we've been exploring. And so what I want to do is another meditation for us to kind of clarify what's next for us with all of these practices. And because we've definitely done, a lot of different guidelines and explorations over these many weeks. So let's go into a meditation. Taking some breaths. Finding our bodies here and now. Noticing how you're doing. So, just for those of you who are interested in this particular guideline, take a moment. If you're not interested, don't worry, we're going to go back to all of them in a moment. But if you are interested, think to yourself, like, what might be a place that you would explore? And it could be the, oh, I feel like I've been treating my partner unfairly and I want to change here. Or I don't like this aspect of my behavior, and it might be nice if I could work on this. It might be something like that. Or it might be, oh, I want to explore more. How can I be more present? How can I bring mindfulness more right into the heart of my sexual experience? That might be an interesting exploration. How can I bring more intimacy? Where are the places that I avoid intimacy? And might there be a way of bringing more connection and more vulnerability? So just to notice what, if this particular guideline is calling out to you, what it might be that you could play with in the coming weeks. And if there's something you want to commit to, you can do that now. Notice how that feels. Taking a breath. And now I'm going to remind us of all of the guidelines that we explored, all of these ethical trainings. And as I say them, just see which one really kind of lights you up. Like, this is the place that I want to keep diving into in my life in these coming weeks. Because even though here in our class, we're going to move on to other topics, but this is always a place of really interesting, profound exploration. So the first one we explored was protecting life, not killing. Whether it was animals or bugs, or what we need to do, or what we feel drawn to do to stand up for protection of life in some way, or for caring and respect for others we know or out in the world. To just notice if that one really draws you and what you want to keep going with, where you want to keep going with that. And then we looked at speech. Remember those commitments to practice truthfulness and harmony-producing speech and kind speech and useful speech, and to refrain from things that that don't feel aligned with ourselves, maybe speech that divides other people, speech that is not true, speech that is hurtful. So where is that my is that the one that I feel? And of course you get a more than one, but is that something that really I want to keep practicing, keep exploring? And if that's the case, notice what that might be. And then we looked at our patterns of consumption, addictive behavior, use of drugs and alcohol, but also we looked a lot at technology, which I think most of us is challenged, or most of us are challenged by these days. And some of you made some really clear decisions. So if you did do something and you've been exploring, what I didn't say so far is appreciate yourself for where you've been successful. Some of you have made decisions around speech and you've stuck to it, or you've stuck to it somewhat, or around protecting life or the way you consume things. Like, where have you been successful? And do you want to continue on and do more? And if so, what might that be? Notice what emerges and how that feels. And then we explored not stealing or generosity. And then today, when we were looking at the nuances of it, it wasn't just like things, but it was also ideas and how we are in relationships and how we hold things tightly versus how we can hold things with a light hand and a loving heart. So to appreciate yourself if you practice some of these. And is there a way that this feels really live and I want to keep going with and just see? And then the last one of, which we already explored. I already had you reflect on about the relationship to sex, not harming through our sexual energy or actions. And also then cultivating mindfulness in our sexual being. So there's obviously a lot here. But if you could now distill it down to just something that is important to you from all that we've learned in exploring ethics, like what does it come down to for you? And it might be the question of how I want to live my life, how I can align myself with my deepest values. How I can be forgiving of myself when I realize I'm only human. That seems important as we close this segment we've done. So just to offer yourself a little bit of kindness and appreciation. There's a lot of people in the world right now who do not care about ethics. In fact, their goal is the opposite. And as we said from the very beginning, that this is an opportunity to stand up for and be in the world the thing we want to see. When we become these beacons of compassion and kindness, and ethics and care for each other and the world. It's like a whole other force that's moving forward, and it counteracts the forces of violence and greed and anger and hatred and all that stuff. So we are, I think it's like very, very powerful to do this work. I'm taking a breath. Notice how you're doing. And then let's open our eyes and we'll end our meditation. Well, thank you all. For those of you who are here for all the classes, some of you might have missed some of them, but they're all put on our UCLA Mindful app and website. If you missed one and you want to go back to one of these six classes about ethics, it's been so interesting and fun to hear your insights and to explore this with you. And I hope it's helpful because it's really taking mindfulness out into the world in all the ways that we engage as humans. So I love those practices. Next week we have a guest coming in, and then I'll be back in 2 weeks. And just wish you all the best with all this exploration. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the UCLA Mindful Weekly Lecture. For more information about our classes, workshops, and retreats, please visit uclahealth.org/UCLA Mindful. Join us each week for a new session on mindfulness.